Every time I see that egg, I remember my sister and think about the golden sunshine concentrated in the center of the world.
Welcome to this month's edition of the New Academy podcast. The New Academy is a monthly reading and podcast series in which we talk with one of our department's NTTs about their creative research, teaching, and community work. I'm Mary Lucille Hayes.
And I'm Dave Morris. Our featured NTT this month is my co-host, Mary. Mary Lucille Hayes is a lecturer in English here at U of I, where she teaches courses in rhetoric and occasionally other areas. As a writer, she writes about Midwestern life and considers herself an ambassador for Midwest perspectives. We'll be talking with her about what that entails, and we'll be talking on writing and teaching writing, and everything else related to those things.
And to help us do that, we have a guest co-host this month.
I'm Dana Kinsey. I'm a lecturer in the rhetoric program in the Department of English, and this is my second year teaching here.
Dana is a RetComp specialist. She got her PhD at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and she taught at UNL and also West Virginia University and also the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And she's interim associate director of rhetoric. She's also a creative writer and has taught creative writing classes. And Mary and I both work with her in different capacities, so we thought she would make an excellent co-host for this podcast.
I'm really excited to be here today.
And thanks for coming.
So, Mary, one of the things that I noticed in your stories was how rich they were with so much sensory detail. Reading them was a lot like reading poetry, and I was wondering about your process, like for capturing so much detail in your stories. Do you journal? What do you do to make them so beautiful?
Oh, that's really sweet. Thank you. Actually, I think a lot of that has to do with my column, my newspaper column, and that in itself has given me a writing practice, without which I could not have really finished any of those stories. And part of the column, the point of the column is it's sort of like an exercise in mindfulness. And if I don't know what I'm going to write about in a particular week, I just go outside and I look and I see there's a chicken over there. She's scratching up in the new grass, you know, just whatever's going on. And that has sort of trained me to be very mindful of sensory stuff and details.
Mm-hmm. So, do you find in like your drafting process you go back in and add extra details about the world around, or does the world around you inspire the stories?
I think a lot of it is incoming inspiration from the world around me. I do a lot of redrafting and revising over and over and over again. In fact, I really can't send a story out for a submission until I've reread the whole thing, usually aloud, and changed a bunch of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wish I could stop doing that because I need to finish some more stuff.
You know, it's interesting what you say about that sensory detail. What really strikes me reading your stories is that one of the things you write about is how people express themselves not in word, how they embody emotion and how they embody relationships to everything around them. And I was wondering if that is something that's long been an interest of yours as a writer and as a resident of the Midwest.
You know, I'm from the Midwest for many generations, and I find as I get older, I sort of embody some of that Midwestern stoicism, and I don't really want to. I want to be like really effusive and hugging people and stuff like that, but it just doesn't come naturally anymore. I mean, maybe it did when I was 20 years old and living in a hippie house, but not so much anymore. And I think that being in that type of Midwestern family and community makes me have to. You kind of have to try to extrapolate what somebody's feeling, because they're not going to tell you. Mm-hmm. They're going to tell you through a hand on the hip or, you know, a cock of the head or whatever.
That's something I think a lot about as a transplant from Western New York and as someone who's married into a Midwestern family.
Okay.
Where I had to get accustomed to the fact that my in-laws didn't complain about things. It's where I come from, complaining is a very important part of emotional communication. It's just everyday background noise. And when I go home now, I think, why is everybody complaining all the time? But I wondered about, just more generally, in all of your bios, you describe yourself as writing about the Midwest as an ambassador for Midwest perspectives. And it sounds like that stoicism is part of it, but we'd love to hear a little bit more about what does that entail?
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I'm still going back and forth about whether that's a corny thing to say, an ambassador from the Midwest. You know, what the heck does that mean? But I think part of what I'm trying to say is I hear a lot of people who are technically from the Midwest, but from Chicago, urban Midwest, mm-hmm. come down here and they want to complain about the scenery. Like, oh, it's so flat here. Well, you know what? Try riding a bike from my house up past Miller's Farm. That's a pretty big hill, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know it's not like hills in some place. And I have always loved the beauty of the rural, and out here it's a rural farmscape, and I'm very much aware that it's, you know, it's not really good for the land, the stuff we do in our farms here. You know, my family farms, and we have corn and soybeans, and it's a monoculture, and there's a lot of chemicals involved, and that's not a good thing. At the same time, I'm very appreciative of the beauty of, you know, looking out my window and seeing those you know, corn stubble can be just really lovely. And I feel a little bit defensive when I hear people saying, oh, it's so ugly here.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine said, you know, anybody can appreciate mountains. Anybody can appreciate oceans. You have mm-hmm. to be a real connoisseur mm-hmm. to appreciate the prairie. And so I feel like, I guess it's more of, not even so much an ambassador, but, you know, I want to fight about it a little bit. I want to defend the prairie.
So your characters then tend to be, and especially your the sort of main character of many of your stories, Ruth, is someone who embodies and experiences a relationship to the landscape that is joyful, loving, also stoic and melancholic, mm-hmm. that you want other people to understand. Aesthetic judgment is a bit more complicated than
yeah, that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was really interested in the ways in which you often seem to intertwine beauty and sort of melancholy, that's a great word for it, or a joyfulness with a sorrow. Mm-hmm. That really seems to inform your aesthetic. Do you think about that when you're writing, or is that something that kind of emerges organically for you?
It must emerge organically, because I never thought that Ruth was melancholic, but I love that idea and I love that word, and now I'm gonna go think about that. So it must be just there, you know.
It strikes me too, sometimes the melancholy is in the relationship between Ruth and the characters around her mm-hmm. husband, her children, her brothers and sisters, as they try to understand her.
There was a moment in your piece, The Sidewinder and the Buffalo Child, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. on recognizing her child, where it was like this terrifying beauty that really struck me to be on a similar mm-hmm. a similar note.
Yeah. I think that piece in particular is, it's supposed to be about a mother-daughter relationship that's very, very complicated. Complicated mm-hmm. by the fact that they're just really different people. Like, how can one kind of person or creature give birth to somebody who's so different? But I think that probably happens a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was curious about the name Ruth, and I started to think about Ruth with the one story that I Will Go Where You Go is at the title, and, mm-hmm. and I thought, I was pretty sure that's what Ruth says to Naomi in the Book of Ruth.
Exactly.
And I was curious about how you see your character, the very Midwestern Ruth, as relating to Ruth of the Book of Ruth.
Okay, that came much later, because actually these stories, this whole cycle of stories, I started one as an undergraduate, and when I went to graduate school the second time to get my MFA, I I started sort of recycling those stories and taking a look at them. And they used to be, originally, they were about different characters doing mm-hmm. different, having different jobs. And then I thought, you know what? This is really all the same character. Mm-hmm. Let me make it that character. Now, when I started, even though I grew up with a Methodist background, I didn't really know anything about the Bible. And I wanted biblical names for Ruth and David. And that's all I knew about it. I wanted biblical names. And I just chose, you know, I think there's a Ruth in the Bible, right? And I just chose them out of the hat. Well, since then, I've read the Book of Ruth. And I did take that quote from the Book of Ruth. Maybe it's a little bit, because it's not that much related to the Ruth of the Bible, except mm-hmm. that one line, which I just loved, where you go, I will go. And to me, it sort of suggests that we're all going there. We're all going to end up, whatever, you know, flying up into the sky or whatever happens. We're all going there. And mm-hmm. so, you know, where you go, I'm going to go too. And so she's sort of, that's sort of addressing David, mm-hmm. Her husband, but it's also just sort of addressing everybody. And I got that title because when I first started thinking about this story, I actually named it the end of the Book of Ruth, and then that led me to start thinking about the Bible, and then I was like, oh yeah, there was that one line. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
So you mentioned your recent return to graduate school. To earn an MFA at Murray State, correct?
Murray State in Kentucky, yes. Wonderful program. I cannot say enough good stuff about that program. It changed my life.
And I've heard you refer to it as transformative, and I wanted to ask you, what do you think about it? What led you to pursue the MFA, and what about it was so transformative?
Okay. Quite simply, it was the only possible way I could ever get a raise at this job, was to get a terminal degree. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I'm going to get a terminal degree. What's the closest place that's the cheapest place? And while I was sort of investigating that, and I was not this smart in my 20s and 30s, but I did a little research and I got a book. Oh gosh, I think it was either put up by AWP, and it was titled like the 30 best low residency programs. I knew I wanted low residency because I couldn't afford to stop working here. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted low residency. And that was very highly rated. It was they considered it a good program. And it was close. And I went there just thinking, I'm just going to get in there, get my degree, get my raise, that's it. But it was just wonderful. So I think part of it for me that was transformative is I didn't really go to school the normal way. When I got my undergraduate here, and I was a townie, so I didn't actually live in a dorm to school. Even with my first graduate degree, I had a family, and it was different. And so part of it was just simply the experience that I had of really, you know, when it's different when you live in a dorm with people and you interact with mm-hmm. them. And even though it was these small pockets, it was 9 days twice a year. Mm-hmm. But still, there was like an intimacy there that I never got in my earlier schooling. But mostly it was just the teachers. I had amazing teachers mm-hmm. there. Delray Phillips is amazing. He's a great guy. He yells at you a lot. He reminds me of like a coach, you know, that,
sounds
you know,
like
he would say about the story where you go, I will go. Here's what he said about that. Why do you always write about flowers? Nobody wants to read about those goddamn flowers. You have so many flowers in your book. You know, he taught me so much he taught me to be, I thought I already was, very careful mm-hmm. on the sentence level. And he would yell at me in class. He'd say, "You tell your students not to do this, and you still do it." So there was that. Tommy Hayes has the same name as me, but no relation, was another wonderful, wonderful teacher that he, you know, and wonderful in a completely different way, just a very careful reader, very loving, encouraging. And Lynn Pruitt was also just a very generous teacher. And I just learned so many different ways to be careful in my writing from them. And also a very wonderful cohort. Mm-hmm. You know, people were just, it was a small, you know, very small classes, but amazing.
Did you do all your coursework in fiction, or did you?
Well, I actually, since I already had a master's in creative writing, but had to take a lot of literature there. Mm-hmm. They actually let me out of all the literature requirements because mm-hmm. I had already done them. And but I still took an extra. They had an opportunity I just couldn't turn down to study in Ireland. So I was in Ireland for 6 weeks, and it was kind of expensive, but it was like the price of taking a class. Yeah. So I justified it. Oh, it was wonderful. Yeah. Yeah.
What's it been like coming back into teaching post-MFA?
I use a lot of tricks. And I show my students pictures of Del Rey and tell them funny stories about him. Like he wore these little wire-rimmed glasses, but then he would have reading glasses hung around his neck. And when he wanted to read something, he'd put on two pairs. So he was just a funny guy. So I'll tell them stories about him and then tell them, here's what he had to say about the sentence. Take care of the sentence and the sentence will take care of you. And he just, I have exercises that are based on stuff that he did in classes mm-hmm. that have been very helpful and I think pretty successful. I think my students actually like them. So.
Nice.
Yeah, I feel very enriched in mm-hmm. all kinds of ways. Well, for one thing, I couldn't have finished the book without that mm-hmm. and it gave me a lot of new material to pass on to my students.
Mm-hmm. When do you find time to work on your book and your stories?
That's an excellent question. One thing, like I said, my column gave me a writing practice, and I've been doing it for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think even a little longer now. And that, I gradually began to realize that there are good times for me to write. Mm-hmm. And morning is one of them. So I try very hard to get my teaching schedule sort of compact. And this semester I teach Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. And I stay pretty late doing tutorials and doing grading. And then I try to do all that stuff here so that I have my Tuesdays and Thursdays to write at home. And those mm-hmm. are my writing days, and mostly in the morning, and then in the afternoon I do other stuff, or I submit, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. What inspired you to start writing your column?
Oh, okay. I think I had read there were some wonderful books. Right before I started writing it, I read a couple of books that were epistolary, letters from a woman homesteader. Her name is on different books in different ways. It's either Eleanor Rupert Stewart or Eleanor Pruitt. And she wrote the most wonderful, she went by herself with her child. She was a single mother. I think she might have been widowed. She went to, I believe, Wyoming and homesteaded, and would write back to the Midwest. I think she was maybe from Chicago. She would write these amazingly visual letters. So I really was kind of into this way of describing, and I thought, I could do that. And then I also read, I think it was Kathleen Norris has a book of, I can't remember the title of the book, but each like essay is called Weather Report. And she also writes, I think she's writing about west of here, like, I don't remember exactly where, maybe Nebraska. But very much expansive, kind of stuff about the landscape, but that is also emotional. And then I've always loved Willa Cather, and really feel like the way she, and that's kind of, you know, I guess I want to be her, the way she embodies the landscape as, but not just the landscape, also the culture of the people, but it's almost like a character in her books. And I actually, I wrote out a few of these things and I sent it to the little weekly paper in Monticello, and I sent it to it's a really small paper, so they don't keep their editors very long always, so I sent it to three editors before one finally said, yes, we will publish. And she was, she was 24 years old. I mean,
oh, wow.
Amazing that she was like the editor of this newspaper, and I think she just didn't know any better, so she said yes to me. And I did that for a couple years in the Monticello paper, and then I queried over at the News Gazette. And but yeah, I think I just wanted to describe, I love to write description. And for me, I think it's a way of connecting.
Mary's column, Letters from Birdland, appears frequently in the News Gazette, and she's writing often about Midwestern life, although I also have enjoyed the times when, for example, she wrote in justification of our NTFC strike and
well, yeah,
a variety of other sort of relevant, directly
might
things
have to
that
do that again
us.
In
yeah,
a couple of
yeah,
weeks.
It seems like next week that's coming back around. But, so, Mary, I think I might have had the idea to do this podcast, but you have done most of the work for
not even true.
organizing this podcast and organizing the accompanying reading series, and I was curious what some of your motivations for that were.
Oh, well, yeah, you did say podcast, and that put a little idea in my head, and I just see the podcast as sort of enriching and adding to the reading series. And what I like about the reading series is I just remember when you were the adjunct liaison or whatever they called it.
The title changed weekly.
Yeah, right. and that you guys hosted a reading like within the walls of the university and, you know, of the department. It was an actual departmental program, but I loved finding out what my colleagues were studying, what their specialties were, and stuff like that. So I just, yeah, that's what I wanted to do with this reading series.
I mean, I remember back when I was a grad student, you know, I really had no idea what was happening among the NTTs. I didn't really know what they were teaching or the rather sort of rich other work, research and creative, that was part of their professional lives. It just wasn't really on the radar. And so for me, it was in part just sort of taking what was already happening and making it a little bit more visible in the sort of Benjamin Franklin way of making more noise while doing what you're already doing so other people notice. What do you feel like the series potentially adds to our department?
Well, I think it gives adjuncts more visibility and also more self-respect or whatever. I mean, just last time we did it when Amanda was our reader, I mean, it was such an honor to stand up there and see my colleagues out there and introduce Amanda. And I think it could give us more, I'm hoping that once we start finding out what each other are doing, that it can really become an academic community and not just us squirreled away in our little separate desks all just doing work that nobody sees and nobody shares. And we can support each other. We can help each other once we find out what everybody's doing, what each other's doing.
One of the things I have enjoyed most about this school year is that I've gotten some insight into you as a teacher, because we've been collaborating as you've done the tutorials for the RET 101, 102 section I'm doing. And so it's been great. I get to observe like the care and attention that you take with students, so I end up feeling less isolated as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And I asked you earlier about the ways that the MFA fed into your classroom, but I'm also wondering about how your teaching feeds back into your writing life. Do you find that it goes the other way, that you get inspiration from your students at all?
I may have told you this already. One student had this lovely term, and it doesn't really make sense grammatically, but I just loved it for some reason. Mm-hmm. She wrote about the dangerous lonesome. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. And I asked her, I said, I love that term. Can I use it in my story? And she gave me permission, and I told her I would, you know, put, if it ever gets published, she'll be in the acknowledgments page.
Nice.
And so I did. And I was kind of planning, since she's our student again, this semester, I was kind of planning on, the book I put it in is not, I don't know if it'll ever be finished, but I'm going to print up whatever draft I have and give it to her just so she can see her name is in it.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah, really because we do develop, they're small classes, and especially when you do tutorials, you know, you develop very personal relationships with students, and so it's not, you know, it's not like my students are really going to show up in my story except for that one phrase, mm-hmm. but still, it's just, you know, it's just more people to notice what's going on with them, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I think so.
I've really appreciated how many of the students who have a real spark around writing, but maybe don't recognize it, how many of them you gently nudge to kind of nourish that. It's really exciting.
Well, and you know, a lot of students come, especially in 101 and 102, they come kind of thinking that writing is just this big chore. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they have really exciting things to say, mm-hmm. and sometimes really original ways to say it, mm-hmm. That might not be a standard grammatical MLA English, but it's still got a lot of life in it, and so you do want to nurture that.
It sounds like then, like some of the teachers that you've had in the past, that simply encouraging and nurturing the development of student voice, mm-hmm. whether it's in academic or creative writing, is a big part of your pedagogy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I'm always trying to convince a student to enter one of our department contests, mm-hmm. and sometimes they do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you, Mary, and thank you so much, Dana, for joining us. This has been a really great conversation. We hope everyone will join us at the Literature and Languages Library on Friday, March 2nd from 3 to 4:30. And watch our website, and you can follow us on Facebook for announcements for next month's reading and podcast, in which we'll be featuring lecturer John Claiborne, who recently published his first academic book, Civil Rights and the Environment in African American Literature, 1895 to 1941. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll see you soon. Bye.